Hi, everyone. Welcome to the FloridaProgressives.com podcast, episode 8 for July 4th, 2014. I'm Mike Itzen. This show delivers news and updates via interviews with activists around the state on the issues that you, the people of Florida, care about. This time, we're looking to our neighbor, Georgia, and how it's dealing with similar issues like education funding. And later in the show, we'll be talking about the issues facing Muslim Americans. As usual, stick around for the end of the podcast to hear a list of actions, groups, and resources discussed on the show that can help you affect positive change. Zed Jelani was an investigative blogger for Think Progress, Republic Report, and the Progressive Change Campaign Committee via the Bold Progressives blog. His work has also appeared on Al Jazeera America, The Nation, Huffington Post, Salon, BillMoyers.com, and many other outlets. He's also cautioning against the anointing of Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee for president on a Tumblr account called Inconvenient Truths About Hillary. He is currently a student at Syracuse University, and you can keep up with the causes and issues he's advocating for at Zed Jelani on Twitter. Zed, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, great to be here.
You went to the University of Georgia. Can you tell me about the types of scholarships that used to be offered there, how that's changed, and also what you think of the governor's race between Nathan Deal and Jason Carter?
Yeah, so actually, those two things I would say are fairly related because I went to the University of Georgia. I guess it's been 5 years since I graduated from there. And when I went, I basically had a full tuition scholarship. So in the 1990s, then Governor Zell Miller championed and he got through the legislature something called a Hope Scholarship. And basically what the Hope Scholarship did was if you maintain a certain GPA, you basically do not pay tuition in a public university, or you get, I believe, somewhat of a discount at a private university, although it's still a much better deal to go to public. So during my time going through the University of Georgia, that standard basically was either B average or a 3.0. I believe they moved it to 3.0 while I was there, but still that was a fairly sort of decent standard. It kept a lot of people going through college. It kept a lot of people from going to other states for college. There's a lot of people who decided to go in-state for college just because of that Hope Scholarship. The problem is, I believe it was now, it's going on 3 years ago now, the legislature under the current governor, Governor Nathan Deal, moved to change that scholarship and restrict it pretty severely by moving that GPA cap up. So now, you really can't get a full scholarship, full tuition scholarship, unless you have a very high GPA. I believe it's close to 3.7, 3.75. Otherwise, you get a reduced scholarship, which has created a mountain of debt for people. Thousands of students have left technical colleges, which are sort of the backbone of the working class college community in Georgia. And we've seen especially large numbers of African-American students leaving college or losing those scholarships because, you know, they tend to come from backgrounds that are more disadvantaged. And that's a very, very high GPA threshold to meet. And, you know, I didn't meet that threshold. A lot of people would not have met that threshold. So actually, it's been along with normal tuition hikes that have been hitting the especially the public universities. You know, we've had a 1-2 whammy on students. I think a big part of the reason that Jason Carter entered the race for the Democrats was because he was very, you know, this was basically his first year in the legislature, I think, when this was happening. He was sort of a freshman lawmaker, and he was very strong in opposing these cuts. There's a lot of Democrats who initially supported them under the idea that if they supported them, the Republicans wouldn't make them as harsh and, you know, they'd play ball. But he was not one of those Democrats who did that. He was very strong against them to begin with. And I think that really created an impression statewide that he was someone who's really strong in education. You know, this, in addition to him opposing the huge cuts that have gone through for K through 12, which have been in the billions of dollars, have really created sort of the backbone of his campaign, which is education. It's talking about how the fact that Georgia, which once led the entire country in financing higher education in the 90s after the Hope Scholarship, now is actually lagging behind the rest of the country. You know, and that happened virtually under two Republican governors, particularly the current one. The last one didn't cut the scholarship nearly as much. So, yeah, I think this has formed sort of the backbone of his campaign. I mean, he talks about education more than anything else. And he has a background, I think, in education as well. His wife's a public school teacher. I mean, yeah, he's a Carter. His grandfather was president, but he comes from a very middle-class background. He lives in a fairly quaint, you know, very middle-class home. His wife's a public school teacher. He was a Peace Corps volunteer in South Africa, where actually he was a teacher in South African schools right after the end of apartheid, actually, in the early 90s. So I think, you know, education is a big part of his life, and I think a big part of what animates him to run for governor, and I think that's going to be a huge issue in the upcoming race.
You know, I saw something on PolitiFact recently that was kind of going over Carter's record and saying, you know, they're kind of dinging Carter for saying that Deal had the worst record on education ever. And I felt that was a little unfair from PolitiFact because the point is Carter is trying to restore a lot of the problems that Deal did by just slashing and burning like so many other Republican governors, you know. But okay, I mean, and I see a lot of parallels between Carter and Deal and then kind of what we're having to face here with Rick Scott. But also another major issue with Georgia was what do you make of the gun law expansions that are happening now? People are allowed to carry guns into once unheard of places like airports and bars and stores. You know, it's much wider scope now for where people can carry guns.
Yeah, so we this law actually was signed into passage basically at the very end of the legislative session. It was sort of on the minds of a lot of the NRA types in the legislature. And I believe it is one of the most extreme laws in the country now on the books. And there might be a couple of other states that do similar. But basically, yeah, you can carry a gun into a church, into any religious institution, into a bar, into a restaurant. Now, those institutions can opt out of the law and say that, you know, for example, Target recently said that people shouldn't be bringing guns into their stores, so you can't bring it into them anymore. But if the restaurant owner or the bar owner has not said anything, then by default, you can assume that you can bring your weapon into those places. And the law actually just went into effect 2 days ago on Tuesday. And we've already seen a couple of incidences of people bringing their weapons into convenience stores and starting arguments and having to call the police. I don't believe anyone has been hurt or killed as a result of this yet, but we've already seen a lot of tensions from this. And, you know, it was a big priority, I think, of the NRA to get this law through. And unfortunately, Jason Carter did support passage of this law. I believe very few Democrats, if any, other than Carter, did support passage of the law. But we've done, you know, there's been a little bit of polling done recently, and 60% of Georgians actually oppose it. So I think that may have been a bad call on his part if he was feeling that it was the right thing to do as far as what Georgians are concerned. And, you know, I guess a lot of what the campaigning right now is happening is that where, you know, people are asking religious institutions and businesses to voluntarily just say, no, please leave your guns at home, because they still have their right to do that as long as they affirmatively opt out. So I think that's a lot of what's happening right now. But unfortunately, given the Republican supermajority and the governor, it's difficult for me to see the law actually being repealed anytime soon. So I think a lot of it's just at the grassroots level, sort of educating people about what this law does and how businesses should just say, okay, you don't need to bring your gun in when you're drinking, you know, in the bar. You can leave it at home or in your car, secured, whatever.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what do you think of any other campaigns this year in Georgia? I think you've been critical of Michelle Nunn for Senate, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Nunn is that, you know, her father obviously had a very long and sort of storied career in the Senate, very well known. But my sense from her is that she was sort of drafted into the race when she didn't necessarily have a whole lot of interest in doing it. And it's, to me, it sort of shows. And if you contrast the way Carter is running, the way Nunn is running, Nunn seems to be giving out a lot of statements of, well, we just want to work together. You know, we should stop fighting. We should start working together. We should start getting things done. She's giving a lot of sort of boilerplate comments, but she's not as skilled in sort of working out the sort of policy details. Her campaign has been very, very underwhelming in terms of how she's putting the Republicans on the defensive. She's not really criticizing them very much. I mean, right now she has one candidate, David Perdue, who's basically the Mitt Romney of Georgia. He's cousin of the governor, who built his, you know, career on laying off people and outsourcing. And the other Republican nominee in the runoff is Jack Kingston, who recently made headlines by saying that poor kids don't have work ethic and that they should be working for their school lunches. You know, so she has, I think, opponents that are very, very receptive targets to being gone after, but she has not been aggressive at all. And I think that's just the nature of her campaign and her personality. Whereas on the other hand, I think Jason Carter has been very strong in going after a deal on particularly education, but also some other issues where he's been really weak. And I think really sort of just emblematic of the problems of Georgia. So, you know, I do think that Nunn is hurting herself by campaigning this way, and that, you know, she has right now about 4 months to turn that around. She is the nominee, but unfortunately, I think that's a lot of what you see in these Senate races, is that the National Democrats tend to pour money into a candidate who they feel like has a name, who has fundraising capability, but they haven't really vetted how they campaign, what their ideas are, the way that they go about it, because I do think it has been very weak in that, and I think that if she doesn't change her strategy a lot, she will lose in November. I mean, I think Carter has a fairly good shot, 50-50, but Nunn, unfortunately, does not seem to be like she's doing anything to convince people to vote for her, and she doesn't have the benefit of running against a weak incumbent like Nathan Deal. I mean, right now, Kingston and Perdue are both running sort of as like anti-establishment people. You know, I don't think that's necessarily legitimate, but I think that's the way that they can do that because they haven't been in that Senate seat and they have, you know, that sort of privilege, whereas Deal has, you know, been overseeing disaster after disaster, you know, whether it was the snowstorm that they couldn't handle, his ethics scandals, which have cost taxpayers millions of dollars, mass layoffs in the education system, you know, cuts to tuition, scholarships. So I think that, you know, right now, Kingston, unfortunately, seems like he's in a pretty good place. And it's hard for me to see that turning around without Nunn really changing her style of doing things and really going on the offensive against him.
Okay. Also, in the past year or two, you see more and more articles about which states out of the South could become progressive, like usually through the message of economic populism, you know, a fair wage issues that really talk to, you know, middle class voters. Do you see that happening in Georgia? I know Carter can, you just said he's basically about 50-50 with Deal right now, but in the next 5 or 10 years, do you see Georgia leaning more towards, you know, a progressive message?
Well, it's really interesting. So if you look at a racial map of the United States and you look at like counties that are like majority Latino or majority African American or significant populations, what you'll see is that the Southeast, and that includes Florida, have massive minority populations, much larger than the Northeast, much larger than even parts of the Midwest, meaning that you have sort of what are the traditional really strong Democratic Party voters, really strong progressive activist coalition people. You have that population there. The issue so far has been that their turnout has traditionally been very low. I think in 2008 was a great peak year for turnout for those voters. But what's interesting is I think the demographics themselves have actually gotten more progressive since 2008. We have more immigrants, both from outside the country and other parts of our country, like especially the Northeast, have been moving in. We have more young people. You know, I think our demographics are becoming more and more progressive. And I think the question on everyone's minds in the Southeast, and that includes Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, especially those three states, is not if we're going to see that progressive majority come into power, but when. Right. So some people are saying that would happen this year in Georgia and in North Carolina, you know, that sort of backbone will be really strong probably in the Senate race. And it's entirely likely that within 4 years, we start looking at these states not as solid red states or even as conservative leaning states, but closer to the politics of what we see in a state like Ohio, where the states are sort of veritable swing states. And then within a decade, we could be seeing them as solid progressive blue states. That's almost entirely due to the fact that we have seen such a rapid demographic shift in these states. And I think we've seen legitimate Republican overreach. I mean, I think on every major issue, the Republicans in the state of Georgia have found themselves on the wrong side of public opinion in recent years because they reached so far. They reached really far by cutting tuition scholarships. They reached really far by putting in the new gun law. They reached really far by attacking voting rights. They've done a number of things where I think they just have not been savvy to the future voting base of the state of Georgia. And it's interesting that you bring up the issue of economic populism. My old boss, Adam Green, always told the story at Progressive Change Campaign Committee. He always told the story about how he worked in the Senate race in South Dakota and how he won over like pro-life people or Christian conservative people by talking about economic populism. But I think there's also another current there that's very strong underneath that's also helping sort of change this region, was that we have a younger group of people in the state who are not anti-gay. They're not anti-immigrant. They're very pro racial equality. So, for example, they did polling in Georgia on people under the age of 30, and I think it was something like 60% of them support marriage equality, right? That's a tremendous difference from the older people in the state, you know, the generation above them. I think that generational difference in social issues, too, is actually starting to hurt the Republicans. Traditionally, it's helped them, but I think now it's actually starting to hurt them. And it's really interesting, the same anti-gay bill that was moving in Arizona died in Georgia, you know, without even passing, I think. I don't even know if it passed out of one body. And I think part of the reason was legitimately because young people were very upset about it. And we were very vocal to lawmakers who were very on the defensive about it almost immediately. I mean, I had very long arguments on Twitter with the bill's chief sponsor, and I think he was feeling the heat. The same day he was arguing with me and a bunch of other people about it, he ended up pulling the bill. So I do think that there's a collision of things here. There's the traditional democratic issues, which are like education, the economy, wages, working people. We have that group of people. And then we also have sort of the immigrant population. And then we also just have the fact that young people in the South are much more socially tolerant and socially progressive than their elders are. And I think that stuff is creating a perfect storm that, yet you will see major shifts in the state, all these states within the decade. Certainly, I can guarantee you that they either will not be Republican states anymore, or if they are Republican states, those Republicans will look more like the Republicans in Massachusetts or New York than they do the current ones.
Also, that kind of leads into how, from a grassroots angle, from the next generation angle, that things are kind of naturally evolving. But from the top down angle, something that you've often written about is how the Beltway in Washington or the North can kind of write off the South entirely. Like, you know, it's a lost cause. Let's forget about it. Would you say that's a fair characterization of what you have been kind of pushing back against? And also, do you think that perception is changing now due to the things that you just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always been sort of the perception in the sense that, like, the majority of people that work in the media and who work in the Democratic Party politics are from the Northeast or from, like, California, basically. So I think a lot of their worldview has been focused on, like, they look at the South every presidential election and they see a solid red block there. And they see, you know, occasional crazy statements by people like Congressman Paul Brown, who, you know, will just say things like, you know, he calls the Civil War the War of Northern Aggression. I've never heard any Southerner call it the War of Northern Aggression, but, you know, Paul Brown's out there saying things like that. And you know, I think the sort of the extreme headline grabbing stuff from the South creates an impression on these people that's very different than if you actually spend some time here and you realize that all these states, you know, everywhere from down to Florida, through Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee, all these states have sort of a progressive movement that's sort of under the wings of what's happening right now. And that movement is sort of on the cusp of changing things. And I think a lot of the reason that people from other parts of the country are giving us more attention, for example, Chris Hayes on MSNBC is covering Georgia, probably giving it, I don't know how many, like 3 or 4 segments a month, good segments, is due to the elections. I think they see the fact that Nunn does have a chance, that Carter probably has a 50-50 chance. I think they're reading that as a signal like the state is changing, right? And, you know, my only comment on that would be that people should take a more comprehensive look than that. I mean, there's a lot changing in the state other than just what happens in the election. And a lot of things determine elections other than just what people think. Like, a lot of it's just the fact that, you know, a lot of people don't vote in midterm elections. So even if Nunn and Carter lose, it doesn't mean the state's not changing. I think the fact that, for example, if you just look at Atlanta alone, it's one of the, which is the capital city of Georgia, it is one of the best places to be have a minority business today. It is more racially integrated than New York City, Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, Boston, Syracuse, you know, all these, most of these northeastern cities. It has a mayor who I have many disagreements with. He's much more of a sort of a business-friendly Democrat than me, but someone who could easily be governor in 4 years if Carter loses, Kasim Reed, who would be our first Black governor. So I think that there's a lot of changes going on under the scene, and part of that's also the Moral Monday protests that started in North Carolina but have spread to Georgia and are likely going to be spreading to Alabama, Mississippi, and South Carolina before too long. Mm-hmm. There's so much going on under the current here that it's sort of visible to us as people living in this region and from this region, but I think that people from outside the region should be looking at really closely and understanding that all this is going to have some kind of outcome. It may not change the region into, you know, a southern version of Vermont overnight, but it definitely is moving us away from, I think, what the popular perception in the country is that we are all far right wing, you know, cross between Ayn Rand and, you know, Falwell.
Okay, let's switch gears a bit and talk about Muslim Americans. There was a perception in the way they were treated because of the attacks on 9/11 and the build up to the Iraq War. You could say that, you know, there were more hate crimes, there were more all these things, but also civil rights issues. One thing that I know that you've blogged a lot about was the New York Police Department spying scandal. So what I'm trying to say is, what kind of civil rights issues are Muslim Americans still facing today, and how does it relate to a lot of, I mean, what other kind of issues in the Middle East that connect to America could you mention that are kind of relevant for the Muslim American community right now?
Well, I think it's important for people to view this issue as sort of as like multifaceted, because there's a few different things going on. And so the Muslim American experience in the U.S., I think, has definitely had its challenges. And I think in some ways, by some metrics, it is a difficult experience and does face significant issues. So, for example, Gallup does polling on people asking them, you know, would you vote for someone if they are a certain race or religion? Virtually every group gets a lot of support, with the exception of two, which is Muslim Americans and atheist Americans, right? Mm-hmm. This is not a challenge faced by, you know, any Christian sect or any Jewish sect or any other really major faith, but it is something Muslims face. And then you reference what happened with New York City. Under Mayor Bloomberg, the NYPD very extensively spied on Muslim Americans simply because they were Muslim Americans, not because of any criminal suspicion, infiltrated groups, you know, had spies at kebab shops, all sorts of, you know, kind of extensive, intrusive stuff. And it's very likely that if Bloomberg had done this to a local synagogue or a Christian youth group or something, that it would have been such a scandal that maybe he would have even had to resign, right? And I think that stuff is reflective of the fact that we've had a lot of challenges and difficulties in the United States. That being said, I also think the Muslim American population is probably the most educated, the most wealthy, and one of the most integrated Muslim populations anywhere outside of like actual Muslim countries like Turkey or Indonesia or Muslim majority countries. And I think that if you're a Muslim in the United States, your rights are much better protected in many ways than if you were in Switzerland, which banned minarets, in France, which banned the burqa, you know, doesn't allow women to wear burqa, or some other countries which criminalize some forms of speech.
Some liberals just cannot believe the idea that we're more progressive than Europe on some issues. So.
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult. And also the fact that I think what's happening with Muslim Americans is sort of an echo of what's happened with other Americans as they integrate into the country. So I think Jewish Americans face a lot of this. Like if you talk to like I have friends whose Jewish parents didn't go to the same school as like Christians because of, you know, it was viewed as sort of almost segregationist, right? And they don't like to even call themselves white, some older Jewish Americans, because they were mistreated so differently than, let's say, Catholic or Protestant white Americans, that they didn't, you know, they don't even see themselves as part of the same group. But today, Jewish Americans have a very high level of integration, very successful in the country. country, and they face a lot less discrimination than they would, let's say, 50 or 60 years ago. Same thing with Irish Americans and Catholics, right? When John Kennedy was elected, a lot of people were saying, well, is he going to be loyal to America or to the Pope, right? Today, no one would really very few people would utter that sort of sentiment, or at least they wouldn't say it in public or out loud or in politics. But that was a common thing to say. So I think what's happening with Muslims, you know, isn't too different than what happened with those previous groups. And I think the great thing about America is that it's a country that normally overcomes those sorts of things, right? Like, yeah, every group has to have sort of its hazing process of getting accepted. But as that happens, and I think it's happening quicker and quicker, I think those groups become well accepted. If you go back to 1990s, I think it was actually 1994, they did polling, and it was like 48% of Americans approved of miscegenation, right? Only 48% of Americans even thought, you know, interracial marriage was okay, right? Today, it's like, I think, over 87% or even higher than that. Mm-hmm. So I think that the speed by which people are becoming accepted in the United States is increasing much quicker than it used to be. And I don't think Muslims are going to have to wait, you know, decades and decades like Jews or Irish or Catholics or other people had to gain acceptance. Now, there is one wrinkle in this is that, you know, the U.S. does seem to be at war in Muslim countries for quite a long time, much longer than it was at war in the Second World War, which obviously created a lot of difficulties for Japanese Americans. So I do think that's an extra element to it, in that there is sort of a tension between Muslim Americans and other Americans because we tend to be at war in Muslim countries right now. There is some inkling of an idea that may not be the case. The administration and probably future administrations are trying to pivot to Asia is what they call it. And, you know, we may have more foreign policy issues in East Asia and in the Pacific in the future. But right now, anyway, I think the wars that we're engaged in definitely have sort of an extra element that makes it difficult for us to see a lot of the reconciliation between Muslims and other Americans and, you know, everything else we've seen with other groups. But I do think that that also has another side to it, which is the fact that because we are at war, you know, people say Americans learn geography every new country we go to war with. Mm-hmm. Well, I think Americans also probably have taken a lot of pains to learn about Islam and to learn about Muslim Americans due to the conflicts that we're in. And I don't think all of that learning is necessarily negative. I think a lot of people are genuinely curious and they want to learn about the Muslim American experience. And so that's really what I embrace. You know, growing up, even in the South, I faced very little discrimination. And even after the 9/11 attacks, you know, I think the majority sentiment we got was people would come to my family and tell us that, you know, if anyone did anything to mess with us, just, you know, let them know because they'll take care of it. You know, there was people who were so neighborly about it. And I think that
because your family's Pakistani American, right?
Right. Yeah. And this was something well known among our friends and family. So, you know, I don't see sort of what we've called Islamophobia. When I worked at Think Progress, we authored a whole report about Islamophobia, which is kind of, there's like a whole industry of people trying to, you know, stir up fear of Muslims. I don't think that will be around forever. Like, it really doesn't feel to me like something that's existential, right? It really does feel like a wave of sort of fear and hatred that other groups in the United States encountered. It has sort of an extra element that makes it difficult, which is that, you know, the foreign policy of the country seems to be constantly putting us within war zones with Muslims and them, which doesn't help. But, you know, even that, I think, will come to pass. So, you know, my view is I'm very optimistic about sort of where America is going with that. I think that particularly with younger Americans, they just, you know, they don't feel the same sort of bigotry and prejudices that their parents do. And even with the younger Muslim Americans don't feel, I think, the sort of like ethnic, sectarian, tribalistic sort of feelings that their parents do. I think most Muslim Americans, I might be wrong about this. I believe most Muslim Americans are either first generation or second generation right now. So, for example, like I never had any problem with Indians or Indian Americans, even though Pakistan and India have had three wars and they still have quite a bit of rivalry or national rivalry. But I'd never had any problem with them, you know, growing up. I would have Indian friends and, you know, we'd pretty much be just Americans. And I think that's the main takeaway here is that in the United States, at some point, everyone becomes American, no matter what group they're in. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's necessarily the case in other places in the world. And I think that's something, like you said, that liberals should think hard about, is that there is a lot of success in integration here. And we see ugly things all the time, but I think our history is sort of a tone to the fact that we do typically overcome those things.
Well, for the fight for national security or whatever you want to call it, I've seen you often advocate for doing more police work with other countries as opposed to, you know, President Obama just decided to extend the war in Afghanistan for 2 more years. Also, he escalated the drone program. Florida Congressman Alan Grayson held that hearing with the victims, the family victims of a drone strike. When you see how Republican ideas, I suppose I could call them Republican ideas, that got turned into also bipartisan ideas, war, targeted assassinations, basically the drone killings. But what do you think? Does that make the way to kind of roll all this back even more difficult now that it seems like both parties are on board?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, with respect to that, I don't think that This isn't necessarily unique to Muslim Americans. I mean, I think American foreign policy has been like that for a long time with respect to a lot of countries and places. But I do think, yeah, that is an extra angle to this in that it's very difficult to imagine that, for example, Guantanamo Bay would still be open if the people there, looked like Timothy McVeigh, right? Because people don't start fights about, can we, should we strip this class of terrorists with rights, but not this one? I'll tell you a story. I was working on my capstone project when I back up in central New York, and I went to the New York State Senate, and they were debating terror trials in New York City. And these good liberal New Yorkers or whatever were basically arguing that New York City cannot defend itself against having a terror trial, so they cut off funding to anyone in New York City who wanted to hold one. Which to me was just amazing because this country has been trying terrorists since the beginning of time in civilian courts, and they try rapists and murder serial killers and all sorts of dangerous people. That's what the courts in place are for. So to me, it would be kind of difficult to imagine all this going down if the terrorists were, white Christians, which a lot of terrorists are. Actually, twice as many terror attacks have come from far right Americans as Muslim Americans, since 9/11. And that debate, it never really happens when it comes with non-Muslim terror suspects, right? So I do think, the fact that there is still a fair amount of fear, paranoia, and distrust around Muslims is impacting the sort of national security policies. That being said, this didn't start with Muslim Americans. The United States has typically been very militaristic since World War II because that's what it has in its toolbox. It has tons of hammers. Every problem looks like a nail. So it has a big military, it has a big intelligence service, has a lot of allies that are also militarily powerful. And I think reversing that takes a conscious effort on behalf of people to reject that sort of longer attitude and also to reject the Islamophobia that I think gives Muslims sort of a special target on their back with respect to how you deal with challenges dealing with them. I think that if we do see more of a reset towards that, it would have to be a big priority of the next president because I do think that President Obama did kind of resign himself to behaving the same way as his predecessor in a number of ways. I mean, I was at a fundraising party one time, and a friend colleague of mine actually talked to Neil Katyal, I believe, who was I have to remember exactly what his role was, but he was working in the Department of Justice, and I believe he asked him something like, why are you guys continuing all this Bush policy? And he said something like, well, it's different when you're in power because, when you're out of power, you can be critical of that. When you're in power, you feel like you have to use all that. So I think a lot of people call this a deep state. There's a way that government does things that when you go into government, you just continue those things. And it takes a lot of personal sort of inertia to reject doing that. And I think that Obama and his political philosophy is very consensus driven. He's not, I don't think anything in his background really makes him a radical, like, Fox News or whatever talks about him. I think he is kind of a go along to get along guy for the most part. And I would hope that the next president who comes around does not have that attitude, because I think that personal attitude actually is very, very important in terms of how you confront things like the fact that the United States is very militaristic pretty much for decades and decades. And, I think actually Jason Carter's grandfather, Jimmy Carter, was the last president who I think very aggressively confronted that. And he wasn't perfect either, but I think he at least had the mentality that America should actively shirk war, and we actually have not had a president since Jimmy Carter who has not gone to war at least once, which should tell you something about sort of the way we've been going about this policy. I do think that we probably will not see a major shift on this under Obama. I think the next major move that he makes on foreign policy that may be positive is if he resolves something with Iran, if he has some good resolution to these talks. That may actually pave the path for the next president to sort of take us off this train, which I think is the best we can hope for, which actually would be pretty good because we've had very bad relations with Iran going since 1979. So if he can get us somewhere to closer relations, normal relations with them, that would be good as well.
Yeah. How does the media portray the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, and what is the reality?
So I think a lot of the problem with sort of how the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is portrayed, and I never really looked at it through this lens until very, very recently, to be quite honest with you. It took a lot of personal experience with this for me to really understand this, was that I think a lot of the way it's portrayed actually is just based on sort of cultural norms and cultural attitudes. So for example, I think that for people in the American news media, the Israelis look like us, they talk a little bit like us, they're very relatable in terms of the struggles they're going through. A lot of Americans, especially after 9/11, imagine themselves as facing the same thing as the Israelis. They have very random, horrific acts of terrorism, things like that. But I think what's lost in the midst of that is the narrative of what has happened with Palestinians and sort of their dispossession. I think if you go back a couple decades, even Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Republican leader, was signing letters sort of criticizing Israel, saying it needs to give up land for peace, so on and so forth. But I think flash forward post 9/11, especially with the rise of the Christian right, which is actually probably the biggest base of support for Israeli policies in the U.S. now is actually the Christian right. Didn't used to be that way, but that's, I think, the modern lobby. I think if you look at it now, a lot of it just is cultural bias. There is a big feeling that the Israelis are very similar to Americans in terms of a lot of their outlook and their lifestyles, and the Palestinians are just, they are backwards, savage, they're very religious Islamic. And that, I think, doesn't form a lot of the reporting. It's not so much that someone goes on CNN and they just say, oh, yeah, completely vulgar Palestinians are savages. They don't say anything like that. But I think in the back of their mind, that's what they're thinking. And that's why whenever there's a flare up like there is right now, there's a huge flare up right now, you'll likely see a long string of either Israelis on television or Americans who are very sympathetic to the Israelis explaining their narrative and their point of view. But you'll very rarely see Arabs. You'll almost never see actual Palestinians. And you'll just continue to have a reinforcing sort of the Israeli narrative. This way that this is presented has sort of distorted our politics about this, in that I think it's denying people the information that I think would make the situation really outrageous. So, for example, I think a lot of people have drawn the analogy with South Africa, including John Kerry now, who recently drew the analogy in private. It wasn't supposed to be leaked, that he thinks Israel would be heading down the road to South Africa if it doesn't resolve things soon. I think, I wasn't even alive during most of the South Africa, movement. But reading back on that, I think a lot of what informed the way Americans and the rest of the West thought about that conflict was the fact that we had just had a civil rights movement in the United States. And I think the media was making a concrete and concerted effort to look at the conflict from the point of view of Black South Africans who were being denied rights. And there were a lot of Black Americans who I think felt solidarity with those Black South Africans. They tended to be the ones leading the anti-apartheid fight. And I think the fact that Muslim Americans and Arab Americans haven't quite reached that level where we have really good media and political penetration makes it difficult for us to be like those people who are sort of explaining what's happening to Palestinians, explaining that their homeland is basically being destroyed by settlements. It's land, more or less land theft. And I think that is what makes it difficult for us to have the same sort of South African style moment where the world just says, no, you guys have to treat the Palestinians decently. Yes, you deserve safety from terrorism, but they also deserve, basic human rights and statehood or voting rights or something equivalent. And yeah, I really do think that that has been a big problem in the United States, but I'm also hopeful that it's changing. And I think the biggest thing that's changing, honestly, really is the internet. There aren't just a few media outlets anymore. There aren't just a few different ways to get your information, or a few different ways to register political protests. I think now it's very, very easy for us to get the Palestinian narrative out there through alternative means. And yeah, we haven't. I don't think that there's probably more than two TV hosts, period, who are sympathetic to the Palestinian narrative. I mean, Chris Hayes on MSNBC is probably one of the best, but even he doesn't cover the issue that much. But I do think that the democratization of information is what's going to break this issue, and eventually break this issue in Washington, because right now in Washington, it's basically viewed as a taboo to even say anything critical of the Israelis ever. Like, you're really just not supposed to do it. The primary reason for the Democrats is they feel like it would lose them donors. They think it's a very, very important issue for donors. I think that's exaggerated, but that's their perception. And the Republicans have the Christian Right Coalition, which I think is probably more powerful in their party than it ever has been, but is losing power overall in the country. So, and I think that would be the same thing with the sort of the pro-Israel donors in the Democratic Party. I think they also would lose power over time, just simply because, the younger generation, in particular of Jewish Americans, is not lockstep on this issue. There's a lot of dissent there. So I think also this issue, we would see some real dissent over time. I don't think it can hold. It's just an impossible situation to hold forever, as John Kerry and Obama have said. So, I do think we will be seeing progress on that eventually. But it starts, I think, by people with influence, whether they're in the media or in the political world, of trying to step up and actually say something dissenting from sort of the taboos that have been constricted on the issue.
Yes, and on the topic of media outlets being able to show the Palestinian point of view, you recommended on your Twitter feed Five Broken Cameras. That was on Netflix. I watched that, and it provides a point of view that, like you say, you do not get in American media hardly ever. So, very good. Okay, final question is, you started a new Tumblr called Inconvenient Truths About Hillary. The idea about this Tumblr is that so often, whether it's the presidential election or state governor, whatever the race may be, the party kind of pushes, or the media kind of pushes, an anointed one, is, I think, the phrase you have used, other people have used. Tell us why you started the Tumblr and why Hillary Clinton should be kind of reevaluated.
Yeah, so I think there's definitely a feeling, and you'll see this from media folks, you'll see it from political folks especially, that Hillary Clinton, it already is the Democratic nominee, which is kind of interesting because, we have about 2 years until the nominating convention, right? And my perception is that Hillary Clinton has a lot of flaws from a progressive point of view, and that progressives form much of the backbone of the Democratic primary process, as well as independents who may vote, who will either vote in the Democratic primary or the Republican primary. So I started the Tumblr sort of to point out a lot of Clinton's flaws, both ideological and political, to show people that actually having a competitive race here and having more candidates would be beneficial. It would allow us to fight on a lot of these issues where I think Clinton won't fight. It would allow people to have a lot of choices which they otherwise wouldn't have. And I think it would be a real disaster if there wasn't a competitive race on the Democratic Party side. Certainly, I think in Georgia, with none, I think we've kind of seen this. The Republican turnout in the primary was huge in Georgia. And most of those people are going to vote in the general as well. Whereas in the Democratic primary, it was very, very little. And I think if we had a competitive race where Democrats were arguing with each other, you know, politely but firmly about these issues, it would be engaging a lot of people and people would feel like they had a real role in the process. If Hillary Clinton is just anointed, then I fear that a lot of progressives will feel left out. A lot of independents who are kind of skeptical of, you know, dynastic politicians, things like that. Those people will feel left out. They may not participate anymore. And we won't have sort of the robust debate you need to have sort of high turnout in 2016 and, you know, a stronger candidate. I think going back to 2008, almost no one would argue that having a strong, robust race on the Democratic side hurt the Democrats in any way. On the contrary, it probably made everyone feel like they got their point across. It had a lot of really good debates about a lot of issues. And I think, you know, the country and the party was stronger for it. So I think the same arguments hold now, particularly because the Republicans, I think, are going to be very weak. They really don't have any strong candidate on their side. So I think now is a great time for the Democrats to have a debate about the future of their party. And that's why I've been blogging on that Tumblr, just to show people that Hillary Clinton has a lot of flaws and a lot of liabilities, and that someone should step up to challenge her. And my prediction, and I can say it now, is that I think within a year, we will stop viewing her as inevitable. I think there will be a strong challenger in the race. I couldn't tell you with 100% certainty who it would be, but I'm fairly certain that will happen. I think there is that real undercurrent there.
You like Brian Schweitzer and Bernie Sanders, right? I mean, I know there's debate whether both of them will enter the race, but they could both be good challengers, don't you think, from a progressive point of view?
Yeah, I definitely think they both have sort of qualities that would make them substantial challengers to Hillary. I don't know that either one will necessarily definitely enter the race, but I'm fairly certain both are thinking strongly about it. There's probably other people. Some people have floated Deval Patrick, governor of Massachusetts. Other people have said, you know, the governor of Maryland will run, O'Malley will run. There are some other names that have been put out there, but I do think Sanders and Schweitzer are a little bit different in that they're both sort of anti-establishment. They both sort of would be running primarily on ideological grounds, whereas I think other people like O'Malley and Patrick may be running more towards, you know, getting a VP slot, getting a cabinet position, which I personally view as less useful to the process. I'd prefer someone ran to try to shift the debate a little bit and to change people's positions, which I think people like Sanders and Schweitzer would be much more likely to do.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Zed Jelani, for joining me today, and thanks for all the work you do to promote the progressive causes.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. There are many parallels to be drawn from Zed's descriptions of Georgia politics and national politics to what's happening here in Florida, whether it's the education funding battles with a Republican supermajority in the legislature, how even progressive champions like Alan Grayson won't actually criticize Israel, or candidates like Charlie Crist that are anointed by the media and members of the Democratic Party. I also appreciate Zed's optimistic view of a progressive transformation of the South, and I hope he's right. It depends on the actions of the progressive movements in each of those states, and connecting good policy to the right candidates and getting out the vote. You can keep up with Zed's writing via his prolific Twitter account at Zed Jelani, and if you follow the links at the end of the transcript for this episode at floridaprogressives.com, you'll see links for his columns, articles, and blogs. And don't forget to check out his new Tumblr at Inconvenient Truths About Hillary. This music is by Kevin McLeod at Compotent.com and is licensed under the Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. floridaprogressives.com is the home to this podcast. If you want to get feedback, send me an email at michael.c.idson@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter at Mike Idson or on Facebook by searching for the floridaprogressives.com podcast. Thanks for listening.